Okay, good evening, everybody. It's now 6 o'clock and time for me to open this open floor hearing. The first open floor hearing for the M25 Junction 10 A3 Wisley Interchange Scheme. Before we go much further, can I just check that everybody can hear me okay? Good, I see thumbs up right from the back, so that's a good start. If my voice does dip, then just raise your hand and we'll speak a bit louder. My name is Gavin Jones. I'm a chartered town planner and a planning inspector. I'm a member of the panel appointed by the Secretary of State as the examining authority to examine this nationally significant infrastructure project, NSIP for short. I will ask the other panel member to introduce himself.
Thank you. I'm Graham Gould. I'm also a Chartered Town Planner and have been appointed to this examination authority. I would add that, as is the standard practice for appointments, both Mr. Jones and I have had to sign declarations of interest, and in my making of a declaration of interest, I have declared that I have been an inspector responsible for the determination of a number of appeals in both Guildford and Elmbridge Borough Council's areas, as well as some of the other neighbouring local authorities under the provisions of the Town and Country Planning Act. But in making that declaration, I'm content that my involvement with that those other cases does not present any conflict of interest.
Thank you. And just for clarification, I've also signed the conflict of interest form. I declare I've got no conflict of interest. I may have done a few planning applications a few years ago in this area, but nothing of any significance and nothing that I think means I'm conflicted on this case. May I also introduce Ms. Eleanor Church on my right, who is the case manager for this project, and at the back with a microphone each, Mr. KJ Johansson and Ms. Candice Patton from the Planning Inspectorate. In terms of the actual procedure for tonight's open floor hearing, if I can just start with a few housekeeping matters. Some of you who have been at the early meetings will have heard this already, but some of you may not. So there are no fire drills planned for this evening. So if the alarm goes off, it's in theory for real. The fire exit in this room is through the doors there. There are fire exits through the side doors in the rooms on the other side of the corridor. Toilets, if you need them, are just either side of the stairs leading up. We haven't had any requests for any special measures in terms of hearing, a hearing induction loop for this hearing, but if there are any such measures, can you please make one of the case team aware of that? There is an audio recording being made of tonight's hearing. All the NSIP hearings are audio recorded. I'll say more about that in a minute, but this audio recording will be made available on the M25 Junction 10 section of the National Infrastructure pages of the Planning Inspectorate's website. That's the website where you can find the details of the documents of this case, and also provides more general advice as well in national policy statements, advice notes, that kind of thing. So that's a very useful website to look at for this case. Do we have any journalists present tonight? Or whether anybody intends to record, tweet, or film tonight's proceedings? Anybody? No, in which case I can move on from that. Please bear in mind that the only official record of the proceedings is the audio recording that will be placed on the Inspectorate's website. Any tweets, blogs, or similar communications arising out of this meeting will not be accepted as evidence in the examination of this application. I now need to say a bit about the General Data Protection Regulations, or the GDPR for short. As I've already indicated, all meetings and hearings associated with national infrastructure examinations are digitally recorded. The recordings are uploaded onto the National Infrastructure website page for this project. This step is taken so that any member of the public who is interested in the application and the examination process can find out what has happened, whether they're able to attend a meeting or not. This is in turn why you see microphones at the tables at the front of the room, and we've got a roving microphones for you if you wish to speak sat from where you are. At this stage, I must make clear to you that because the digital recordings that we make are retained and published, they form a public record that can contain your personal information and to which, therefore, the GDPR applies. The Planning Inspectorate's practice is to retain and publish the recordings for a period of 5 years from the Secretary of State's decision on the Development Consent Order, the DCO. Therefore, if you participate in the hearing process, it's important that you understand that you will be recorded and that you consent to the retention and publication of this digital recording. However, my colleague and I will only ever ask for information to be placed on the public record that is important and relevant to a planning decision. And it will only be in the rarest of circumstances that we might ask you to provide personal information of the type of information that most of us would prefer to keep confidential or private. But in order to avoid the need to try and edit the digital recording, what I would ask is you try your best not to add information to the public record that you would be that you would prefer to be kept private or confidential. So things such as your age, your address, any health issues, that kind of thing. If you start to stray into that territory, then we'll stop you anyway, because you might do it without realising you're doing it. But if that goes on to the digital recording, it becomes quite difficult to redact it digitally. It's not the same as just putting some ink across a piece of paper. So if you start to stray into personal information territory, we will try and prevent that from happening. However, if you genuinely consider there's no alternative to the disclosure of such information, we will agree a process with you to make it available without forming part of the public record. And if you really feel the need to give us that kind of information, I would advise you to speak to one of the case team about it, and they'll be able to advise you on the way you can make that information available to us. The normal way to do that would be to ask you to make general oral submissions, but to include the private and confidential information as part of a written submission. In terms of the digital recordings, does anybody have any queries about what I've just said and how it relates to the GDPR? No? Okay, thank you. In which case, I'll move on to talk more generally about tonight's open floor hearing. We're conducting this meeting in accordance with sections 92 and 93 of the Planning Act 2008 and the Infrastructure Planning Examination Procedure Rules 2010, specifically Rule 14 relating to procedure hearings. Our task as the examining authority is to examine the application and prepare a report with a recommendation for the Secretary of State for Transport. So we don't make the final decision, we write a recommendation report, the Secretary of State will make the final decision. The purpose of this evening is to give individuals and community groups the opportunity to speak directly to us about the matters which you consider important or directly relevant to the examination. There's no set agenda, and the hearing is not about a particular location or topic. However, there's no need to repeat in your oral evidence material that has already been included in your relevant or written representation, as we've already read that. It will also assist everybody in making sure that everyone is heard tonight, that if a previous speaker has covered points you were going to make, that you just simply indicate your agreement with those points rather than having to repeat them at great length. We will have a record of all the points made, and they will not gain any greater weight from being repeated by a number of people. We do have people who have indicated they wish to speak, and so we'll take those people first. However, if anyone has not indicated that they wish to speak but decide they wish to do so throughout the course of the evening, please just let one of the case team know, and then at the end of the evening we'll give the applicant the chance to briefly come back on any of the points that have been raised that they wish to address. When we call you to speak, we would invite you to come and sit at the front of the table there. However, if you don't feel comfortable doing that, we do have roving microphones available, and you can use the microphone and speak from where you're sitting at the moment. Either's fine with us. However, I would ask if you can speak clearly and close to the microphone so that everybody can hear you. And for the purpose of identification and ease of reference, could I ask that at every point in which you speak, you introduce yourself, give your name, and if you're representing an organisation, can you please give us the name of the organisation you're representing? I also need to advise you that any new evidence that you present in your oral representation should be included in post-hearing submissions. These include written submissions of oral cases, and the deadline for these is deadline one in our examination timetable, which is Tuesday, the 26th of November, 2019. That's to ensure that everything you say has been recorded accurately. Before I move on to the people speaking, does anybody have any comments to make on the procedural matters for this evening? No? In which case, turning to the people that have indicated a wish to speak, and this is in no particular order whatsoever, I would stress. The first person we have is Mr. Richard Reary Smith.
Not very well. Let's see if we can do better. How's that? Is that better? Yeah. Good. Okay. Thanks very much. My name actually is Richard Ray Smith.
My apologies.
That's all right. I'm chairman of Painshill Park Trust. So I think I'd like first to apologise for taking up your time this evening, because I didn't expect to have to. The reasons for our concern are touched on in our written submission you already have, and will be gone into in more detail in the one we will submit before deadline one. So tonight I can be very brief. And first, I'd just like very briefly to remind everybody that Painshill Park is an 158-acre, Grade 1 listed English landscape garden with many Grade 2 starred buildings in it. It's a jewel of England's heritage and is today recognised, as it was in the 18th century, as one of the most outstanding examples of an art form in which England led the world. Possibly the only art form in which England led the world. It is, I believe, much the most important heritage asset covered by the DCO. Last year it was visited by 120,000 visitors. This year, visitor numbers are up by about 20%. Highways England's original proposals for widening the A3 could have severely damaged Painshill Park, and I'm very happy to say that over a year of very effective and constructive discussions with them, we've managed to arrive at a very satisfactory compromise, which I believed answered all our concerns. Throughout those discussions, it was always recognised and minuted at our meetings that the access at the west end of Painshill would either be retained or replaced. At the meeting, as an example, on November the 15th, 2018, it was minuted, and I'm quoting from the minutes, assurances were given that the Trust will be able to use the access road for emergency purposes and for service vehicles working at the west end of the park. That's the end of the quotation. So I was astonished, sir, when at the last moment in April of this year, we found that in the DCO submission, this entrance had been removed. This means that there is now only one vehicular access to Painshill, which is at the eastern end of the park. I mentioned Painshill is 158 acres. It's also over a mile long between east and west. So at the right, at the east end of the park, this entrance comes in through a trade gate onto a single track path. This means that in order to get to the buildings and people at the west end of the park, There's an extremely difficult, tortuous track when we're open and busy with a lot of pedestrians on it. And this means that the delay in getting emergency vehicles to the west end of the park puts the buildings and the people in them at increased risk. It will also make a significant effect on the Trust's ability to restore the west end of the park. Our restoration program, which has been going on for almost 40 years, is now turning to the west end of the park. The two key buildings in it are the Grade 2 star listed Gothic Tower and the recently restored Temple of Bacchus. The Gothic Tower was destroyed by fire some years ago, and we have restored it completely. It has been lived in by members of staff until comparatively recently, and will be again. And there is and is used as a cafe and for other purposes. I would like at this point to refer to the government's national policy planning framework under the heading Proposals Affecting Heritage Assets. Paragraph 193 says, when considering the impact of a proposed development on the significance of a designated heritage asset, great weight should be given to the asset's conservation. And the more important the asset, the greater the weight should be. 194 says, any harm to or loss of a designated heritage asset should require clear and convincing justification. Substantial harm or loss of assets of the highest significance, and the framework defines assets of the highest significance as being either Grade 1 or Grade 2 starred registered parks and gardens, and Grade 1 and Grade 2 starred listed buildings. Paynes Hill is a Grade 1 registered park and garden and has a number of Grade 2 starred listed buildings on it. And says that this harm should be wholly exceptional. That relates to substantial harm, and one may question, is the harm of taking away that access substantial? My trustees and I feel that it is. Constraining our ability to manage the land and restore the landscape, and by making it more difficult for emergency services, putting our visitors, our buildings, and those living in them at increased risk, seems to us a substantial harm. Others may disagree, in which case paragraph 196 is the relevant one, where it says, where a development will lead to less than substantial harm to the significance of a designated heritage asset, the harm should be weighed against the public benefits of the proposal. So what are the public benefits of the proposal? The proposal we're referring to is not, of course, the widening of the A3. There's no question about that. It is the removal of the entrance at the western end of the park. At a meeting with Highways England on the 29th of July this year, they stated that there was no technical reason why the access route could not be extended by 400 metres to allow an entrance to Paynes Hill, and that the reason that this extension was not included in the DCO submission was that time had run out. Now, I suggest that this is an entirely unsatisfactory reason for putting Paynes Hill's visitors, its buildings, and those who live in them at risk, and for restricting the Trust's ability to maintain and restore this outstanding example of England's heritage. I hope, sir, that before the end of your examination in 6 months' time, Highways England and the Trust will have been able to work together to resolve the situation. Thank you. I don't think I have anything else to say.
Thank you very much, Mr. Raismith. Just a couple of quick factual questions. Firstly, is the Western Access currently used by members of the public to gain access to the park, or is it staff and maintenance vehicles only?
It's not used by members of the public, and indeed its use by the Trust is quite infrequent. It's important, but infrequent. And of course, in the event of emergency, it would be used as well.
And the other one, the extension to form a new access. So that would effectively be a new access road leading onto the public highway?
An access road is planned for the three plots of land to the north of Payne's Hill. Those plots of land, incidentally, are part of the listed landscape, but they are not owned by the Trust. And the Trust has agreed to allow Highways England to use some of its own land to take a track off from the Payne's Hill roundabout, running alongside the A3, past a farm owned by Mr. McAteer, past the Girl Guides, and past Close Court Farm. If that track were to be extended by 400 metres, it would come to the western end of Payne's Hill. The proposals up until the submission of the DCO actually did have that road extending there and indeed beyond, and therefore the western access was going to be available.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ray Smith.
Okay.
That's clarified that, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, the next on my list is Louise Russell from Payne's Hill Park Trust. Okay, you're are you happy, Ms. Russell, that Mr. Ray Smith has covered the points you wish to make? Okay, thank you very much. In which case, I've got Ben Garbutt representing Mr. Alderson.
Good afternoon. Thank you, sir. My name is Ben Garbutt. I'm of Keystone Law, and I represent Ron Alderson, the landowner of Park Barn Farm. That's the site at in the northwest segment, north of the M25 and northeast of Buxton Wood. So our concerns are the extent of the land take, essentially the acquisition of common land and open space as replacement land to compensate for the permanent acquisition of and rights over special category land in the scheme. That breaks down really into two separate components, sir. First of all, the ratios which have been applied to that calculation of land take, we say, lack any proper justification. They're more than doubling of the amount of land taken is now being substituted as replacement. And we have queries over the historical context used for that ratio. Essentially, it is a gross overestimate of what is required to compensate for land taken in the scheme, in our view. And there's a second component to this, which is that other alternatives which have been looked at but discounted, we believe, have been discounted without, again, proper justification, in particular the land at Pond Farm, which would have been more central to the SPA, could well have been taken. And the reasons given for that, we say, are not adequate. Really, the conclusion that we reach is that the tests, the relevant tests, which are set out in the Planning Act 2008, section 131 and 132, can be met in this scheme without any land take of from Park Barn Farm. There are three separate fields which have been identified on that patch of land. And allied to that, that there's no compelling need in the public interest for the scheme as proposed in its current form. And just to add to those chief, I think, concerns, there is a need, I think, for some clarity over a couple of other issues. I've seen some late information come in regarding the historical context. I believe there was what's been described as an historical anomaly with the status of some land which ought to have been swapped under the original junction scheme, which I believe is currently held by Highways England, the applicant, which is in the process, I believe, of being swapped or sent, transferred, I should say, to Surrey County Council. I believe there's going to be an update at some point during the examination, but so I think there needs to be a specific timetable for a question on that, so that essentially the examination is kept up to speed with what is happening. I think there's a lack of clarity over also what is the status of the land as it is currently held by High Res England, which is subject to that potential swap. And then finally, a question perhaps that you raised earlier, and in which case this may well be covered, but the question I think you asked was, what is the current status of common land? What rights are currently enjoyed over land currently used as common land, which is being taken in the scheme? I think it would be helpful to know at least where the information is in the application documents that say exactly what those rights are and how that land is enjoyed, but without which we can't really make a proper balance in terms of the new land being provided against that which is being taken. And I think finally, sir, there is some programme time for compulsory acquisition matters to be raised in January. But we would just simply ask that there is sufficient time given over to these concerns, which we say ought to lead to the deletion of the land in its entirety, and there may well be other ways to solve what we are concerned with in relation to those issues I've just described. But certainly to have some time in the programme, if it's not mid-January, then at least that you think about the need to identify time for those specific issues to be repeated and explored. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Garbutt. I would just point you towards deadline one, which is the request for notification for a CA hearing, that, as you've alluded to, a CA hearing. And thank you much. And if you wish to make a written submission of your oral case as well, which is also deadline one, 26th of November.
Thank you. Yes, I was aware of the deadlines. I think my perception from earlier was that there was quite a lot being squeezed in between January the 14th and the 16th. So there obviously needs to be time, but that's for you to decide. But I just wanted to make that point.
As to what hearings we conduct in that January slot, it's not yet fully determined. There may be a compulsory acquisition hearing, I say, not established. I'm not sure whether you were here earlier in the day when we were talking about general process, but it does need to be borne in mind that this is fundamentally a written procedure. Hearings are used when it's particularly helpful to expand upon cases, or written evidence is just not taking us far enough. And depending on how matters progress, there will also be the scope anyway when we get to March, if we feel that we need hearings, that there could well be a compulsory acquisition hearing at that stage. So there's no closed doors or anything. But if parties wish a hearing, then as Mr. Jones has indicated, it's important that deadline one, that is flagged up.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you very much, Mr. Garbutt. The next person on my list is Regina Colt. Hope I've pronounced your name correctly.
I'm a member of Surrey Amphibian and Reptile Group, but I'm here just speaking on my own behalf. I welcome the tow tunnels that are being planned in Old Lane and the Green Bridge that is being planned. Now, I would like to ask for more measures to be built. We look at the four quadrants that have been fragmented by the M25 and the A3, and in the southern quadrant, we have Ockham Common, I think that is the SSSI, which has sand lizards, which are protected species, and it has adders, which are nationally very vulnerable species. Adders are also found on the Wisley side, the western quadrant, and there was at least one sighting in the eastern quadrant. And we all know that fragmentation of population isn't very good for the gene pool, and it'd be great if these populations could be reconnected. And so ideally, the Christmas wish list would be to have a green bridge over each of those branches going off from the roundabout, so that all four quadrants would be reconnected. So the second, so this is about the reptiles. The second issue would be the tow tunnels. Where the lake is, the big lake, Baldermere Lake, there used to be, in historic times, there used to be a toad crossing across the A3. In those days, the A3 was not very busy, had fewer lanes, and so toads used to have a chance to get across. In the meantime, the road was expanded, and there's just no way a toad can make it across alive at that, with the amount of traffic. There's just, you know, toads, the pace at which they go, the size they are, it's not going to happen. So that toad crossing has dried up, not because there aren't any toads, but just because they never get across. So they would be toads if they could. And what happens with the adult toads? The adult toads will go back to their breeding pond, but they'll also go back to the same hunting grounds. So obviously the population on the other side of the A3 has probably dried up, unless they come from other ponds. But the toadlets, the babies, when they turn into toadlets, they'll just go in front of them. They just walk in front of them. So they would want to go back over the A3 in front of them if that was where they would happen to be. But they just get wiped out. So the population gets decimated at that location. So ideally, we would also like to have tunnels under the A3. And brilliant that there's going to be underpasses under Old Lane. That's really great. And I'm a bit concerned about the new road that's going to be put, the connection from Elm Lane to Old Lane. Now, with this new road, essentially what you have, that whole section around Baldermere is going to be hemmed in by roads. And admittedly, the new road, Elm Lane, is just a residential road, so you wouldn't expect a lot of traffic. But because that is the sort of safest area for the toads to go to, you'll find sometimes what you get a load of toads sitting on that road. And I have actually experienced that in the toad crossing that I work in, where we have a quiet road, and there's lots and lots of toads, and you just need one single car to wipe out hundreds of them in one go. So I would strongly push for mitigation action there as well in that new road. And the final point I'd like to make is that there's a bit of a concern about the Wisley bypass that has been created. I know that there was some discussion, and it's quite a bit of a controversial issue, but I understand that no matter what scheme would be used, it'd be, you know, result in loss. So I think, but there would have been less land loss if the Wisley bypass path had gone along the eastern side of the A3, along the outside of the Wisley Gardens. There would have been less land loss and probably less loss to wildlife. The way it is routed now, it constitutes fragmentation of habitat again, and so greater land loss as well. So I'd like to ask the applicant to reconsider. I'd like to ask the RHS to reconsider. I know that they were very, very unhappy with the proposed solution at the time. I'd like to ask them to reconsider their position as well. Because with this road, with the bypass going along the A3 at the top, along the gardens, you have the one-time destruction of precious old trees. But on the southern side, you also have destruction of trees, but you have year on, you have killing of wildlife on that road because it does fragment habitat. So it's like the gift that continues to give, or you could say the curse that continues to give a curse. So that's, thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Cole. Thank you. Okay, the next person on my list is Christine Donovan from Girl Guide in Greater London West.
Good evening, sir. I'm very novice to this whole process, so please forgive me if I get a bit nervous and I will do my best to put forward the case that we'd like to raise tonight. Hayswood campsite is owned by Girl Guide in Greater London West, and that covers the London boroughs of Kingston, Merton, Richmond and Sutton. And it's been our county campsite since 1949, 70 years ago, having recently celebrated our platinum birthday. We've over 5,000 members from the age of five. The site is also often used by our girl guiding neighbouring counties of Surrey East and Surrey West. We also encourage the use of the site by schools, and one of our regular users is a specialist provider for young people who are not in mainstream education. The campsite has two permanent residential blocks, as well as huts for wet weather and other activities, used throughout the year, including winter months. It is maintained and run by our adult volunteers. We have no paid employees. It enables young people to gain experience in the outdoors, learn independent skills, gain confidence, as well as provide a safe environment for fun activities. The importance of the outdoors for the mental health and well-being of our young people today is well documented elsewhere. We wish to continue to be able to use the site in the future and retain ownership of as much of the current site as is possible. When Highways England published their proposals for changes to the M25 Junction 10, the impact on the site seemed reasonable. However, following the first public consultation, plans were changed and the revised plans had significant impact on our campsite, and we had serious safeguarding concerns for our young people. Collaborative discussions with Highways England and their consultants Atkins in early 2019 led to the non-motorised user route being moved to the other side of the A3. During the additional non-statutory targeted consultation on the revised proposals in April and May of 2019, we raised concerns with Highways England Atkins. However, we did not receive any response to our concerns for almost 5 months, and that was after the submission of the draft development consent order. Our concerns are around safeguarding and the environmental impact. To speak first about the safeguarding, Girl Guiding requires all volunteers who have unsupervised access to our young people to have both a disclosure and barring service check, DBS, and complete safeguarding training. However, with the proposed access route for our neighbours to access through our site, this policy will be compromised. We have recently held discussions with our neighbours, who have 8 lodgers, about the right of access through our campsite. Although we have a very good relationship with our neighbour, the reality is that the proposed route leaves us once again with serious safeguarding concerns. It would be possible for any of the tenants, their friends, family, delivery drivers, contractors, and utility company personnel to have access to our young people. This is even if security barriers are put in at both the entry to the route and the campsite. If there is a high fence with new trees planted along both sides of the track, this would sever our site in two. Our volunteer warden would be cut off from those staying on site and would need to go through 2 sets of gates to reach and support them. We had discussed this proposal previously with Highways England and thought that this had been quashed as not being sensible. When we raised it with them on the 3rd of October this year, they indicated that they had not intended this to be the case, and the map provided was inaccurate. The environmental impact. We're concerned that the volume of trees that are to be removed to create the new access road for our neighbours. In our discussions, we had been led to believe that the rerouting of the gas pipe under our current track would have minimal impact, as the land would be restored afterwards, and it would only be a rare occurrence that further access would then be required. However, the development consent order documents indicate that the width of the track is to be significantly widened. This can only be achieved by removal of more trees. Although it is not clear on the map, we see the age of our woodland to be the same on both sides of our current track. and it is on the other side of the track that we have our ancient sweet chestnut tree that is of regional significance. The current plans seem to indicate that this would be removed. We would like consideration to be given to creating a single independent access route for our neighbours adjacent to the A3, which could be securely fenced, as we had proposed this previously. We were told that this was not possible for two reasons. One was the cost of embanking this route, and the second was it would take an additional strip of ancient woodland. However, the removal of additional trees to widen the current track within our site is going to take more trees from this area. We believe that we would, in fact, lose no more trees in total if the access route for our neighbours is adjacent to the A3, and it would enable us to continue to use the full area of our remaining site whilst maintaining our safeguarding responsibilities.
Thank you very much, Ms. Donovan. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, the next person on my list is Richard Max. No, he was here earlier, but he may well have gone. Okay, so the last person on the actual list, i.e. people who have indicated a wish to speak so far, I've got Robert Brown, please.
Good evening, and thank you for this hearing. I have primary concerns, firstly about the cost of the whole scheme and the potential creep of increased costs. As an engineer, I think with the money, something better could be done. My principal second concern is regarding Payne's Hill roundabout. I live in, and through a narrow road and gates, we enter Payne's Hill roundabout. Payne's Hill roundabout, during the peak hours, is very, very congested, and you're taking your life in your hands, trying to merge with the traffic. The additional, the scheme as it's proposed, in my opinion, is going to increase traffic on Payne's Hill roundabout, going down towards the M25 junction 10. And then for vehicles traveling back from junction 10, principally is going to cause congestion throughout Cobham and on the Byfleet Road. Since no facilities seem to have been provided. Regarding the access road that leads from McAteer Farm up now through, on the proposal, up now through into Christmas Tree Wood, that access road shows on the conceptual drawings, shows no barrier, no fencing, and no acoustic fencing, which is necessary to prevent the noise for the 30 or so residents in Payne's Hill House and the surrounding estate. I won't mention pollution, but I will mention the noise level, which is going to occur, unless some fencing, if this access road goes ahead, some fencing will definitely be required, and basically the whole of the area is then subject to travellers, which Payne's Hill Park have had previously. I'd urge you to look at alternative solutions for the entry point of this new access road. At the present time, it's just going down off the slip road, and that is going to cause a backup onto Payne's Hill roundabout. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Thank you. Those are all the people who have indicated so far a wish to speak. Before I hand over to the applicant, is there anybody else who would wish to speak this evening? Hand up. Yes, do you wish to speak from where you are, or do you wish to come to the front? You're perfectly welcome to come to the front if you wish. Okay, if you could introduce yourself, please.
Good evening. My name is Annie Cross.
and I am chair of the Lovelace Neighbourhood Plan Steering Committee. And the Lovelace Neighbourhood Plan covers the areas of Ripley, Ockham and Wisley. It has been submitted for examination, and the local authority, Guildford Borough Council, commenced a six-week public consultation on the 4th of November. Following the consultation, the neighbourhood plan will go for examination and then for referendum to see if the residents and businesses of, and interested parties within Lovelace approve the plan. I would ask you to forgive me because I only heard about today's proceedings yesterday and I'm not prepared. I came along this morning and I wasn't aware I could make a presentation. So I'm afraid I've jotted these down as I've sat here, not had time today. In the Lovelace Neighbourhood Plan, we have Section 3, which is called Constraints and Challenges, and it looks at the M25A3 Junction 10, the RHS increased membership, the possible development at the former Wisley Airfield, and a possible development at Garlick's Arch, which is at the other end of Lovelace. To look at each of them, Junction 10, for Junction 10, the main construction compound will be at the Ockham Interchange on the Ripley side, and that is shown on the map on the screen as the green area by the Ockham Interchange. The RHS will plan to increase its visitor number from 900,000 to 1.4 million by, I recall, about 2020. The former Wisley Airfield would like to develop the owners and put in 2,000 plus dwellings. And Garlick's Arch, which is at the other end of Lovelace, the other end of Ripley Village, would also like to build 550 dwellings. The concerns, or part of the concerns within the Lovelace Neighbourhood Plan, are traffic and carbon emissions, both on the SRN and LRN road networks. Junction 10 will have quite a large number of construction traffic which could pass through Ripley Village. The RHS has a membership and therefore has a number of repeat visitors, and repeat visitors coming from the south, although Highways England say that there will be signs to divert them up to Junction 10 so they can go from the south to Junction 10 and then return to the Ockham Interchange, is highly unlikely. If people know the roads or if they use sat-navs, they will cut through Ripley Village. For the former Wisley Airfield, were that any development to take place there, there would be both construction traffic and residential traffic, possibly between 3,000 and 5,000 cars, as the public transport is extremely poor, and although it's proposed to make that better, it's not sufficient, not considered sufficient. So, Junction 10 traffic, the RHS traffic, and possibly former Wisley Airfield traffic all come from the north of Ripley and focus on the, have their main entrance and exits at the Ockham Interchange. The Garlick's Arch traffic, it is proposed to make the Burnt Common roundabout at the other end of Lovelace, also on the A3, into a four-way junction. The Ockham Interchange is a two-way junction, and I've just mentioned the amount of traffic that would come through there. Also, a lot of traffic from the north comes through Ripley to access Woking Station, which is the only station in the area other than Guildford with fast trains to London Waterloo. And this is a severe problem now. With extra traffic, it will become increasingly difficult. The Guildford's local plan and Highways England are, I believe, looking at a four-way junction at Burnt Common at the other end of Ripley to help supposedly alleviate the problems through Ripley, but traffic going to Woking will inevitably shortcut, as will RHS membership coming from the south. They will shortcut through Ripley. So to summarise, what I really wanted to know is that the Ockham
interchange is not being considered as a four-way junction by Highways England. They say that this is due to the presence of a service station to the south, approximately on the A3, approximately 1 kilometre away. However, there is a restaurant close to the Cobham turnoff, which was closed for over 30 years, and that has been reopened recently as a Starbucks drive-through, and this is only 200 to 300 metres from the Cobham interchange. So the arguments really don't stack up there. And I think that all of these developments need to be taken into consideration because of the potential problems both for traffic and traffic emissions. And I don't understand why Highways England would not consider a four-way junction. They are stopping their works at the Ockham interchange. So what I wanted to ask, two questions, one question actually is, can we submit the Lovelace neighbourhood plan with a written representation? And also I wondered, had Highways England considered a 50 mile per hour speed limit around the Junction 10, which is used elsewhere in the country to control traffic and seems to work quite well, rather than spending so much money on this interchange? Thank you. And I apologise, as I say, they are drafted quite quickly, those comments.
Thank you, Ms. Cross. As regards to the submission of the neighbourhood plan, yes. And for anybody else, submission of oral cases, please, from today. Deadline one, please, which is the 26th of November, Tuesday the 26th. So, yes, on behalf of the parish councils and, yes, the neighbourhood plan group, yes, certainly, we would welcome submissions. As regards to speed limit, possibly that's something the applicant would like to pick up when they respond in a minute.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In submitting the neighbourhood plan and making any comments, it's important, though, if we could just ask you direct us to the particular parts of the neighbourhood plan
that
you think are most relevant.
Yes, it is actually, the traffic situation is mentioned throughout quite a lot of the neighbourhood plan, but yes, we'll look to guide you to the relevant places. And the neighbourhood plan has been submitted by Ripley and Ockham Parish Councils.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else wishing to speak? No, in which case I would like to offer the applicant, should they so wish, the chance to respond briefly to any of the matters raised this evening. 10 minutes, please, Mr. Chalice, thank you. And of course you have the chance to respond in writing at deadline one as well.
Sir, thank you. Mark Chalice from BDB Pittman's for Highways England. I will be keeping this brief, but I would just like to respond, if I may. First thing to say, I do think it's fair to say that Highways England has made strenuous efforts to meet the concerns of local people and local organisations affected by the scheme, and has also had very full regard to the environmental value of the area and its various statutory environmental designations. But of course, balancing all these things is a difficult, if not impossible, task. And Highways England has done all it can to fulfil that, whilst of course ensuring that it delivers a scheme that's in the public interest. We've listened this evening with interest to all the points made, and of course many of them are linked. And also there's quite a lot of complexity behind a number of the points raised. And I don't therefore think I can do the matters justice by just dealing with matters in a few sentences in response to everybody that's spoken this evening. A number of points raised are in people's responses, and we don't, no complaint about that, but we will be responding to the responses that have been submitted. And also, no doubt, sir, you'll be dealing with a number of the matters raised, a good number, if not all of the matters raised, during the course of the examination in rather more detail, then I can hope to deal with them here. Last point to make is that we, Highways England, continues to engage with numerous stakeholders. We've touched earlier upon the need for statement of common ground with certain particular stakeholders, but even beyond those that have been named, Highways England will continue to speak and liaise with people affected. And that's what I think I've got to say tonight in response. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. Just before we close, may I remind you all that any new evidence that you have presented in your oral representations should be included in post-hearing submissions, and that includes written submissions of oral cases at deadline one, please, so Tuesday the 26th of November. Finally, I would like to thank you all for attending tonight and for the very useful and helpful representations you've made, all of which will be considered by the panel. And the time is now 7:01 by my laptop, and this open floor hearing for the M25 Junction 10 A3 Wisley Interchange Scheme is now closed. Thank you very much.